This is Geek Speak, episode 45 of season 16. I'm Lyle Troxell. This week, a slightly different Geek Speak format. In the second half, I'll chat with Alex Fishman and Dimitri Fink, founders of Bugsee, a bug tracker and manager app for the developers. And they give you a detailed view of the bugs that people are experiencing in your apps, and with tons of information on what happened that caused the crash, including a video showing what the user was seeing when it happened. But first, phishing attacks have been a bane of the online world for years. Recently, the security awareness training company which produces a simulated phishing platform, sent out a press release warning customers of an FTC-based phishing scam. The Federal Trade Commission is the organization that investigates and prosecutes phishing-type crimes. And I decided to have a conversation with Stu Schoerman, the founder and CEO of KnowBefore, to learn about this interesting case. Stu, your company helps train people to understand and detect when they might be the target of a phishing scam. Is that a good way to talk about what you do?
Yeah, we essentially train employees to be a smarter security decision maker. We train them how to spot the 22 red flags related to phishing and make sure they don't click.
I find it fascinating that FTC was hacked. So this whole story is about the reason I heard about this case was about the 1998 scammers actually cracking into the FTC's credit card system. Is that kind of how? Can you explain the case to me a little bit?
It was not exactly that, but really close. The FTC has been working on this case for 20 years. There was an outfit in 1998 who bought 3 million email addresses and voicemail and no, well, not voicemail, email addresses and snail mail addresses. And what they did is they charged all these people's cards for in essence bogus X-rated website visits. So they got 3 million credit cards and charged them 10, 15, 20 bucks for a non-existing charge. And it took the FTC literally 20 years to get the money out of foreign banks where all this loot was stashed.
So basically what happened is the FTC found out about this case probably through one of these people that got charged fraudulently. And as they investigated, they realized there was a lot more fraudulent claims that people hadn't issued a rebuttal against. And they could have done that just because they're not paying attention to their credit card bill, or they could have done that because it was embarrassing or they even forgot that maybe it was something that they had done. So effectively, the FTC decided to go after this company and actually try to recoup funds to pay these people back who might not have even known they were a target. And I'm assuming this is one of those things where you get an email, you get a letter in your mailbox that says, hey, you could be a plaintiff in a class action lawsuit. This is the kind of thing you would be notified if you were one of those plaintiffs.
Correct.
So 20 years they're working on trying to get the resources out. And a lot of money actually been sequestered away. And of course, using funds in this day and age requires electronic transfer. So this is a cat and mouse game over 20 years of trying to get the funds back.
Yeah. It was offshore. It's amazing it takes this long. But they are at the moment mailing some 322,000 checks to victims.
322,000 checks right in the mail. And this is like $419. Maybe it happened a few months, so maybe it's like $40. It's not a lot of money per user, right?
No, it isn't. Okay. That's why the bad guys were thinking they would get away with it.
So what's the actual phishing scam, though?
The phishing scam is that the bad guys are using this as, ooh, we can trick people into clicking on a link. So what they do is they go to the FTC website and they look at the current cases that have been resolved. And, you know, you can just, it's a lazy way of creating a phishing attack. It's ftc.gov/enforcement/cases/proceeding/refunds. So they just go there and they look at, oh, who's here that that is currently being money being paid out, like Volkswagen settlement. And so they create phishing templates based on that particular theme, and then they say, click on this link to find out how much money you're getting back from the FTC.
And then, of course, they structure a website just like the FTC's website, so when they click on it, it looks like it's okay. And then, of course, they're asking information like a bank account to transfer the funds into, things of that nature.
Exactly. There's a multitude of nefarious ways that you can use that particular clicking link. You can...
Yeah,
I mean, you can drop a keylogger on their workstation. You can infect the workstation with ransomware. You can do a credentials phish, so you scrape their username and password. Tons of ways you can monetize, quote-unquote,
phishing. And that targeted link that's in that email that looks like it's coming from somewhere. I mean, that's the thing, is that the individual plaintiff kind of remembers that case and is like, oh, yeah, I'm going to get reimbursed by VW, or I'm going to get reimbursed from this 20-year-old case from this credit card transaction. So they're kind of expecting it. So it feels like it's from somebody you know. And that's, of course, the trick when you want somebody to open an email, is you want them to assume that they should. And that assumption is all about playing on the ideas of what's appropriate and not. And it's a very tricky thing to teach people. And that's actually kind of the focus. What's the best recommendation that you have about trying to not get scammed?
The golden rule is take 2 seconds and think before you click. There's two major if you have to break them out in two large buckets. One of them is take advantage of something interesting or profitable. Mm-hmm. On the other side is preventing something that could be negative or destructive. If you get an email that is a themed in either one of these two large buckets, you have to just watch it. Do not click on any links. And certainly the second part of that rule is don't open an attachment you did not ask for.
Right. So, and a lot of this awareness of a user, it's really important, because, of course, even if the email is completely not malformed, even if the website doesn't have any kind of vulnerability that a user wouldn't necessarily know that the machine had, it's still possible to get people's information, just asking for banking account information. So at any level, there's like it's not just a technology problem. It's a user problem. It's a person problem, right?
Yes. The bad guys go for the low-hanging fruit, and it is much easier to hack a user than it is to hack software or hardware.
Right.
Their time is money too. So they go for the biggest bang for their time. Most of these guys are Eastern Europeans, and they have free reign. Local law enforcement is not helping our law enforcement to get this blocked.
It's so frustrating, I think, in this case. What makes it so interesting is this idea that the FTC, which is exactly the body that wants to fight this kind of misuse of finance and trade, is the one that's being taken advantage of, as you know, the users of their clients, if you will, are being attacked directly.
Yes.
It's very insidious.
It is ironic, to say the least.
Yeah. Stu, you're also an author of multiple books, 4 books, and your most recent is Cyber Heist, The Biggest Financial Threat Facing American Business. What is the biggest financial threat? I haven't read your book. I'm sorry.
Oh, okay. No. The book is called Cyber Heist for good reason. Essentially, cybercrime has gone pro over the last 7-8 years. There are different generations. But at the moment, you're dealing with a well-organized underground economy with all kinds of specializations. There's even escrow services for criminals that don't trust each other so that they can still do business. And the cyber heist is ultimately the bad guys get into your bank accounts and empty them out for a small business that could be disastrous, or at this particular point in time, a ransomware infection that infects all your workstations. And if you are a medical hospital, all your MRIs and X-rays and all your other machines that run on Windows are also essentially encrypted and taken hostage. So you're going to have to pay 30, 40, 50K in ransom. That's also a cyber heist.
Yeah, so, and the ransomware definitely getting to the level of professionalism is the scary part of it. At one point, it might have been individuals, but there's a whole economy in this scale is scary because, of course, one bad actor can do a certain amount, but a team of bad actors working together can do untold amount. We've covered stories of police departments being having all of their data being encrypted for ransomware, and also hospitals. And it seems like most of the time, the best thing to do is to actually pay them. But of course, that produces an incentive for them to do it more and more. Why is you mentioned Eastern Bloc and local governments kind of letting them do what they want, some of these situations. Why does that exist?
You have to kind of look at macroeconomic and large world political forces here. Vladimir Putin is ex-KGB, and you probably have heard the expression, once a spook, always a spook.
Sure.
He is using the hackers in Russia as essentially part of his asymmetric warfare with the United States.
His political agenda, he's using it for that.
Absolutely. Yeah. As long as they don't hack inside Russia, he leaves them be. And now and then, when an ex-Soviet satellite state misbehaves, he makes a few phone calls, and the next day their energy is down, and all their banking is being DDoSed, and they're being essentially attacked through the internet, and where he still has plausible deniability, he's just using this as part of his arsenal.
Yeah. So you think that's mostly what it is because the Putin and the Russian government wants to use it as an arsenal. It's like it's an intentional thing rather than a lack of ability.
There's no doubt this is intentional.
Okay. And when we're talking about the attacks, you mentioned in your book title that facing American businesses, it's also facing American government as well. But we definitely see it in the business sector. It's really quite easy for some company to be taken advantage of this way. What kind of economic growth are we seeing as a result? I mean, of course, training and such is one thing, but there's obviously a complete motivation and a counter in this. Are you seeing it not grow fast enough? And what's your feeling on our ability to fight back this threat?
It's fairly difficult to find good ways, good countermeasures, and mitigate a threat like this. You're looking at bad guys that use the internet, and the internet itself is where, to a large degree, the problem is. It was never built for security. It was built for redundancy. The packet needs to arrive. We don't care how it gets there. And that is, to a large degree, where the original problem lies. Let me tell you one interesting fact that very few people know. In 1978, when TCP/IP, the protocol, was mere a glimpse in Vint Cerf's eye, this is now somewhat facetious, but the question was asked, should we encrypt the TCP packets? And the NSA at that point in time put their foot down and said no. And that is where this whole thing started. So it wasn't built for security. If we want to have secure computing, we need Internet 2.0.
Well, actually Internet 3.0, because Internet 2.0 has already been claimed as a faster network. It's still TCP/IP.
Fair enough. Yeah. 3.0. I'll take it.
3.0. Or maybe a different protocol completely, but of course we would still call it the internet. I agree. Of course, we are seeing like DNSSEC as one option to help, but a lot of these are just mitigations. They're not solutions. So Stu Showerman founded your company to teach people to help people realize the human side of security and how neglected it actually is. So you offer your services to businesses and teach the staff and employees there to be better aware and more protective of what they do online. Is that a good synopsis of what you achieve?
Yeah.
And of course, you teamed up with Kevin Mitnick, who's a friend of the show, of our show. We've had him on years ago when he first got out of jail. And he's, of course, a famous hacker who talks a lot about the social engineering aspect, which is really what we're talking about. All of these scamming types of attacks are social engineering. The trick is that our computer environment has no social cues. It's very hard to know. When you talk to somebody on the street, you have all this genetic history of knowing how humans interact. You can kind of suss somebody up. Online, it's just a picture and some text, and there's no way to really know the intent of the person that's actually serving that content, or if you are not being served by the correct person. In any case, it's definitely a big problem, and thank you so much, Stu, for joining me on GeekSpeak today.
You're very welcome.
Was there anything you wanted to touch base on before we said goodbye?
I would only say that I just sent you a spoof test, just for fun. If you check your inbox, if you get an email from yourself, then you know how easy it is to spoof the from address in an email.
Yeah.
And the last thing that I would want to say about Know Before, it's a three-step process. You do a baseline test, you fish everyone, then you train everyone, and then you send frequent simulated phishing attacks to everyone. And that actually is a very good way to create what we call a human firewall and mitigate some of those attacks.
So you emulate what spoofers would do. You emulate that yourself. But instead of the landing page being malicious, it's a training tool.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, I've seen that. We've used it before at Netflix where I work. And I think it is a very effective way of kind of reminding the users what potentially is out there.
Exactly.
Well, thank you. Thank you so much, Stu. I did get the email, and it does say it's from me, though I filter my email through Gmail, and it says lyle@geekspeak.org, which is my email, via know before, your domain. So it detected that it came from your domain. But, of course, that little bit, I noticed that. And I noticed that because, of course, it's me, right? It's not this. If this went to somebody else, there's no way that they would know I didn't send it, right? Who knows? Yeah.
It's that easy.
Yeah, it really is.
Thanks very much, Lyle.
Thank you, Stu. Take care. I want to give a big thanks to our patrons. We currently have 25 active patrons donating at least $1 a month to support this program. We volunteer to make GeekSpeak, and we have been doing so for the last 16 years. The $106 we received in October covers our bandwidth costs and allows us to spend a bit on marketing in order to bring the show to more people. In October, we were supported by Pat Hayter, Chris Irwin, Glenn Nelson, John Winston, Alexis Chen, Nirajis Clenius, and 18 other people. Thank you so much for supporting our program. It means a great deal to me and Miles and the rest of the geeks. I have Alex Fishman. He's the CEO of Bugsy, Bug Report. We'll get into what it actually is. And Alex, thank you so much for being here on GeekSpeak.
Thank you so much.
And also Dimitri Fink. And Dimitri, thank you very much for being here. Are you CTO?
Yes, I am a CTO.
Are these titles because you're more technical and you're more businesslike, or is it crucial that these titles are the way they are? I'm always curious about startups, like how you decide to name yourself.
I don't think they're crucial, but yes, he is the smarter one.
That's how you define it.
Yes.
And of course, he has his business smarts. It's very useful for you, Dimitri, right? Well, thank you for joining me. I'm amazed at the timeline you're dealing with this company. So let's get into it.
So we started working together at a company in Israel called Zaran. We used to make chips for DVDs and digital cameras before Netflix and iPhone killed both industries. And I was working on digital camera industry, and Dmitry was working on the DVD side. And that's how both of us got here. Zaran relocated us independently, me for the digital camera industry and Dmitry for the DVD side.
And Dmitry, you have some Android developer experience, yes?
Not Android application experience. I was involved, like after DVDs and DVD recorders, I was working at Palm, working on phones, WebOS, and I transitioned into Android as well. So I was working at TI on Android phones, and I was working for Amazon. We were doing Kindles and Fire TV.
Uh-huh.
Yeah. So mostly on the system level.
So you guys both now are founders of Bugsy. And I guess you started in January of 2016. So it's a relatively new company.
That's correct.
And do you have a third employee as well who's also doing developing or something of that nature?
More than that.
Oh,
we are eight people right now.
Oh, okay, great.
Yeah.
Okay, so let's talk about the founding of a company together. Obviously, one thing to do is trust your partners. You guys trust each other. So that was an easy part. Mm-hmm. How'd you come up with wanting to be in the bug reporting and analysis space?
Well, we'll have to take it even earlier than that.
Okay.
We actually co-founded the company together 2.5 years ago now. And we raised a significant amount of money and built a team and revenue and customers and everything. And revenue was growing, and luckily everything was going well, but just wasn't going well enough. And at some point we realized that despite we having 17 people team and growing revenue almost from day one, it just doesn't look good. And we don't see a path to
this. This is the menu. And
that's correct. So the name of the company was Dishero, and we basically offered a way for restaurants to be very transparent with their customers and for the customers to trust the menus in a way that's not available to them online because of the user-generated content doesn't necessarily does justice
to the menu,
right. Mm-hmm. And our customers, our restaurants, they paid us to be in a system. They were very happy with that. And you know, the system continued to grow, basically started to grow and continued to grow from day one till the very end. But the growth was very painful and difficult to predict. And at some point, despite having 1.5 years to go on our existing funding, we didn't see a path to either becoming profitable or being in a position to raise the next round.
Mm-hmm.
So we came back to our investors in July, the end of July of 2015. So it's a year ago now, and told them that that's the case. And we think we should shut down. And after a brief deliberation between Dmitry, myself, and the other co-founder, we had another co-founder at the time, and as well as our board, and Manu Kumar from K9 Ventures, who is the lead investor and a board member in the company, we decided to shut down. And
that must have been hard.
Oh, yeah. I actually wrote a blog post on Medium about that, and that actually got a lot of attention on the web, including Wall Street Journal, actually.
Yeah. I mean, when to decide that your baby's been invested years on and people are relying upon to
absolutely
shut it down.
Absolutely. And yeah, we even had revenue. I mean, it wasn't big, but it was growing. And we didn't see it going anywhere. And we had to be honest with ourselves. We just didn't want to end up running the business into the ground and just run out of money. So when we came and offered that solution to the investors, they told us, you know what, keep the money, see what you can do with that.
And okay, we want to be in the next round.
Exactly.
So the investors liked you, and probably partially even at the end of you saying, we could run this out, but let's do this more intelligently. That's probably something that an investor goes, hey, I can respect this person and trust them.
That's a fair observation.
Uh-huh.
And so what happened in August 1st of 2015, which is a year ago now, we ended up with a team, co-founders willing to work together, tons of money in the bank. I have no freaking idea what to do with that.
That's great. That's a beautiful spot to be in. I mean,
you would think so.
You would think so. It's actually not that easy. And I actually, as I said, they wrote another blog post actually last week about that. And that's quite akin to marrying somebody in 90 days. So basically setting up a goal saying, you know, somebody you're going to spend the rest of your life together. You're going to work through a lot of challenges. It may or may not work out. You're going to get some blessing. You're going to need some blessing from your parents / investors.
Right.
And you have to do it in 90 days. You know,
that's
it's
tight.
Difficult to find a boyfriend or girlfriend in 90 days, let alone getting married.
Yeah.
So we had a deadline in January 1st, you know, 2016. So we had about 3.5 months to do that properly. And
how many different ideas did you spit around?
Dozens and dozens and dozens.
What was the runner-up?
If
you hadn't done Bugsy, what would you have done?
That's a good question. I don't remember now.
I don't remember either.
Because as soon as you made that commitment,
right,
it's all in.
Yeah,
right?
So
this is the one.
Yeah, yeah. Top speed.
Yeah, it was tough. It was tough. And we had two groups of ideas, ones that we kind of conceived ourselves and another group of ideas that we, you know, basically took from others. We met with a lot of people. So Dmitry, as the smarter one, he led the first group effort. And I'm as the slut, the networking slut, actually took the lead on the second effort. And we went through dozens and dozens of ideas and eventually came up with Bugsy at the end of 2015, around December timeframe, you know. Did a quick prototype, did the research, obviously. Luckily for us, Atlassian, the maker of Jira, went IPO last year. So they filed their S1. So Goldman Sachs did the market research for us. So it was very, very timely. It was very timely.
Does the makers of Jira, do Atlassian, do they have a product similar to yours?
No, they have their market is developers, right?
Same market space. Right, same market. So when they did that IPO, they got research on how much your
right,
cap
how many developers
is.
Are there, where it's going, how it's growing, right. and what are the challenges, as well as they disclose all their financials
right.
to go IPO.
But they didn't do their they didn't do competitive analysis. You guys must have done had to do some competitive analysis.
Of course. Just for the sake of market research sure. in terms of you know how the size of the market and where it's going. So yeah, so Goldman Sachs helped us a lot in that in making that decision. And yeah, so once we decided that's what we want to do and the one of the decisions, one of the reasons we made the decision is because we had similar challenges in building our previous companies. We can totally relate to the challenges of reporting bugs and explaining everything that we had to the developers who sometimes are in different time zone. So it's not necessarily easy to report all the issues and then it takes, and they come back with questions and it takes time.
All right. So let's get down to what Bugsy actually yeah, is. How did you pitch this to the person that's already given you money? Right. So now you're just going to come and give to your investor, hey, this is what we're going to do. Give me your elevator pitch of what Bugsy was to be. Yeah.
Just to clarify, the money was already in the bank.
Sure.
They're giving us.
You know,
so the money is already in the bank. So it's a very, very different situation. Yes. So Bugsy is a bug reporting tool that allows you to report that every bug that gets reported using the Bugsy system is accommodated with includes a video recording of all the user actions leading up to the problem, all the touch events, all the network logs, all the console logs, and everything is being shown to you on a dashboard in a synchronized fashion. So you click a button, you see exactly what the user did, what was happening right before the problem, and you can see all the network and all the interaction with the server and see if there's a server error or there was no network.
Okay, so, and I took a look at it. It looks like you're using using pods, CocoaPods, which makes it extremely easy for a developer to install this. You kind of tout on your intro video that it's like one line of code to get this thing up and running, which is pretty great. We see a lot more of that kind of easy development feature set. Let's describe for the general audience that's not a developer. When you say bug reporting, what you're talking about is someone's building out an app. I've got a little app that I'm making for a local bar in Santa Cruz, and it allows you to record what beers you've drank at the bar, and at the end of the cycle, you get your name on the wall, okay? So in that situation, I have network connections, I have photos to be uploaded, and all these different things. When I get it ready enough, I'm going to want to share it with a group of people that are kind of alpha testers. They're not customers. They are people that I trust to test it. And so I'll deploy it out with maybe Test Flight. It's an iOS app, so Test Flight allows you to push apps to people using the App Store methodology, but not to the general public. At the end of that time, because they're in this kind of beta cycle, they have a special build of the app that allows them to report bugs to me. Sometimes you'll see an implementation, you shake the app and it grabs a screenshot and then kind of prompts you to type some stuff. And then what you get in the bug report is an email effectively that says, I ran into this problem, whatever they write. And of course, the knowledge that they can give you from using the app is pretty minimal, right? Mm-hmm. Not network request connections, right. Not what was leading up to it necessarily. Mm-hmm. So the bug reporting tool you're talking about allows me as a developer to very quickly produce a much better reporting on all the alpha testers I want to include, that they can report things that are really rich in detail. Is that kind of
that's very correct, but it's even broader than that. So there are three phases of development. There's internal development, mm-hmm. then there is a beta testing, exactly what you alluded to, as well as live in the App Store. So there are very different phases, and you expect different kind of reports. So that's one aspect. The other aspect, there are two kinds of problems. One kind of problem that you see with your eyes, like a picture didn't load, mm-hmm. didn't do what you expected, like a non-intuitive UI, or a misspelled text. Another kind of problem, it's the app just crashes, right? It just dies on you. No warning, no nothing, just boom, dies, right? So in all of these cases, Bugsy comes and they will report to you 1 minute of video that led up to the problem.
Even in App Store production?
That's correct. So basically that one line of code that you talked about, it passes everything that Apple requires you to pass Apple certification, and we pass Apple certification, and we have many customers live in the App Store.
So you have customers live in the App Store where even if the user doesn't report it, like there's not been an interface, if it crashed,
yeah.
What happens is hopefully the file system saved effectively. Next time it boots, it takes that payload and sends it off, and you get a user, you know, crash completely and video going up to that moment.
That's very correct.
Okay, that's pretty cool. My day job is working at Netflix. I'm an engineer on I work on the iOS app. There's any time we think about what we do, we're very conscious of privacy mm-hmm. of the users. And in general, inspecting what they're doing or looking over their shoulder without notifying them would feel something we definitely discuss, whether it'd be a good idea to do that. Even though, of course, all the image assets and everything they're doing, we're delivering to them. Mm-hmm. Some applications like a web browser that would do this kind of thing could have a lot of privacy concerns that an end user might be looking at their email and it crashes and all of a sudden you've got a picture of their email. So how do you decide on what – do you have best practices for your developers?
Absolutely. So first of all, Bugsy automatically removes every secure field from the system. So whether it's a password, whether it's credit card, whether it's the picture from the camera, from the phone, whatever it is considered to be secure is automatically removed. That's all within this one line code of integration.
Okay, right. So you've actually kind of made sure that some of the things you can detect are private, just turn it off. That way I won't log it. I don't really care what it is anyway, because that's not going to solve the problem.
And it doesn't even leave the phone. So it's not like it goes to our servers and there we process it. It doesn't even leave the phone. So it's very, very secure in that front. And on top of that, we offer you APIs where you know that certain screens should not be recorded and you preemptively can disable Bugsy in certain screens.
So let's you have a web browser screen. Mm-hmm. You do that. So okay, so from that perspective, makes sense. Are you always the middleman? Do these crash reports and log reports go to your services or do they go to the individual developer or is there different, depends on the partnership?
I'm not sure I understand the question.
So when, let's say I take my beer app and it crashes and I've used your system, are the images and the last minute of video and all that log report, does it, when it boots back up, send to me or does it send it to you?
So
as a service.
It's uploaded to our server, and then you get an email, and it goes to your Jira or your Slack or whatever you need, and obviously it sends you an email, right?
Oh, okay.
Right.
So you've integrated with your Slack.
Yeah, we integrate with like 15 different bug tracker and the collaboration tools.
To be clear, when you talked about Jira, Jira is a really well-known bug tracking tool made by Atlassian. Yes. It's used. We use it here at Netflix.
So do we.
Yeah, it's a great app.
It's a great,
really great app. And they have APIs, of course, for integrating other things into it. So when one of these bugs occurs in your system, you have a tab that an extension, if you will, to the Jira system, and it actually logs it right into Jira. So from a developer's perspective, if you're used to using Jira, perfect. It's right there.
It just shows up there. Yeah. Right.
Okay, so cool. So you've got some security concern issues. The developer has to trust that. Of course, all developers have to deal with this privacy issue, right? So it makes sense to me that they've got to be the one that decides what's something that's valid and what's not. I can imagine my little buzzing in my engineer brain is saying, you're recording video all the time and tossing it all the time. Isn't that a bit of processor time and a bit of memory and a bit of disk space? I mean, how are you doing that efficiently enough to always be running a 10-second video? Dimitri?
Yeah, so when it comes to space, we are talking about 1-minute video, so it's a couple of megabytes. It shouldn't be a concern, right? Obviously, CPU is being consumed, but we have spent a lot of time fine-tuning and optimizing our solution. We actually have some know-how in the area.
Uh-huh, that's good.
Right. So we have achieved a solution that doesn't visibly slow the UI, right? You would not notice. It's not noticeable.
Okay. Are you, lots of times in bug reporting kinds of things, you actually want to do a sample. You don't want to do a full 100% of everybody's crashes. You want to do a 2% of all issues. And in that way, you're not overloading yourself with you know, errors.
Yeah, so
do you guys support that?
So actually, we have a for crashes, we have a solution. So first of all, we detect similar crashes, right? So we combine them into one report on our end, but we also don't collect all of them, right? If you have a popular app and you have thousands or millions of similar crashes, we collect some amount, let's say like 10 first ones. And then when the similar crash happens, we actually instruct the device, you know, no need to send us that. Right, we already have enough.
Right.
As a developer, if you don't think that it is enough and you need some more sample data, you can come to our web interface and just click a button. I need some more for this issue.
Nice.
Right. So we will collect 10 more.
Even if you don't get all the reporting, like you're sampling of the actual reporting, do you still get a count of how many times that's happening?
Yeah. So we still gather all the statistics and we show you like all the graphs, like which devices it happens on, which build, and so on.
Okay. Right? I'm sold. It sounds really intriguing. I think I will throw this into my toy fun app. What's your model for making revenue? Are you advertising based? Are you sharing the data? Are you just straight up charging the developers?
Great question. First of all, thank you very much for considering using Bugsy. That's first of all. Second, we're not sharing data and we're not planning to share data. So just to be very clear about that. As for charging, we are right now at a free mode because let's roll back. We started working on it in January this year. We rolled out our beta at the end of April. So we're talking about we are 4 months old live. So, you know, we just started. So the Bugsy offering is entirely for free right now while we're figuring out shit out.
Out.
And we plan to roll out our pricing in probably October timeframe. Mm-hmm. And we're still experimenting with different charging models, but it's going to be per usage kind.
That makes sense. You're in a situation where the price point makes sense for the developer.
I mean, right. We're still experimenting. And we're talking to our customers and asking them what makes sense to them, what would they pay. A lot of customers reply to us with phenomenally positive feedback. And I said, okay, that's a beautiful opportunity to ask you. What would you pay for that? And we collect all this information.
You talked about the three different phases of development, right? The kind of internal, the beta, which is pseudo-public, and then the total public, and you operate in all those situations. I could imagine that having this running all the time as developing would be extremely convenient. Because even though I'd probably always ignore it because I'm rapidly developing, I'm crashing regularly, I'm, you know, debugging code. Sometimes a situation can happen that afterwards I go, wait a second, what actually happened there? Mm-hmm. And be able to have a video real quick of that moment. It would be very useful.
That is very correct because, I mean, obviously crash report includes the stack trace and often enough it's sufficient, but sometimes it's you don't know why that in the pointer was null to begin with, right? Mm-hmm. You see you dividing by zero, but why you're doing that, you don't know, right? So that's why the video and the network trace and all this information that led to the problem is sometimes crucial to understand what had happened.
I can imagine the network log could be relatively large. Are you doing any kind of compression on that? Are you saving the entire session at network log or only the last couple minutes?
So currently we are just setting a limit on that. So we just record packets that are no larger than 5K. And so on.
Right? So streaming video wouldn't get in there.
And just XML, JSON, or some other text.
Right. No images and things.
Yeah, no images. Yeah.
But if I launch the app with your system and run it for a day, checking my email, and then it crashed at the end of the day, we're going to see in your log, we're not going to see all that network traffic, right?
No, we are talking just about the last minute.
Okay. Yeah. All right. And is that flexible on what the duration is?
Yes. Okay. It's fully configurable. You can make it larger or smaller.
So since you've been rapidly developing so quickly on this, you're just starting in January, have you been doing, and your customers happen to be developers, do you get a lot of feedback on what stuff people want? Is it driven partially by your user base?
Absolutely. We get a lot of feedback from our customers by just saying thank you, and it helped them to save a lot of time, both on the QA side as well as on the developer trying to debug the issue. But they also come and say, like, we want this particular functionality, or we ask them what would you like to see, and those conversations lead to a lot of good outcomes.
So you're definitely not in need of things to do, I would imagine. You're extremely busy.
That's for sure. And we still have a relatively small team, so it's not easy.
Yeah. So how big is your team right now?
So we're two co-founders. We have one iOS guy, one Android guy, one web guy, and two designers.
And your web system is in beta, and your iOS system is in beta, your Android beta. Android's still being developed, yeah?
So iOS is fully deployed. We have many customers live in the App Store, so that I wouldn't call it beta anymore.
Okay.
We're just not charging for it yet, so we're probably sure at this point. Android is definitely in beta, and we started it later, and it turned out to be slightly more difficult than we originally expected.
Why is that? What kind of technical problems emerged?
So usually when you're talking about Android, people think that it's an open system.
Yeah.
Right. So actually, it was much harder than iOS because on iOS, we could achieve a lot of things by kind of instrumenting stuff in real time using Swizzling.
Using right? what?
Swizzling.
What's that?
When you can replace a method of a class.
Ah, yes. That you can do in Objective-C.
Yeah. You can do it in Objective-C. You cannot do it in Android.
You can also do it in Swift, can you?
Swift, it's still like Swift currently using Objective-C system classes, so we are okay for now, right? Mm-hmm. Until they rewrite the whole foundation.
And have you mentioned? Okay, so from that perspective, because you can kind of inject yourself in the language core, it's relatively easy to do this in an Objective-C based system.
So tasks
in Android.
Tasks that took us few hours on iOS. Sometimes we have spent weeks on Android.
Oh, really? Interesting.
Yeah, like intercepting touches, for example.
Yeah. I mean, part of this, of course, is that you don't want to be a pre-compile step, that you kind of inject yourself in the app. You're not interested in doing that, right?
We want it to be a one-line integration. We don't want to mess with your build system too much or like make you go through hoops.
Yeah, because of course that would be you could tackle it very differently if you did a build time, just rename all their methods and calls into yours. And
maybe with Android we could do that in the future when we could integrate easily as a plugin into the Gradle system.
Yeah, exactly.
But we haven't looked at it yet.
Yeah,
we are planning to.
And of course this also depends. Okay, so... Apple is slowly moving towards Swift, and as we, you know, their next WWDC, they're going to talk about more of the fundamental part of the, AV kit, UI kit, slowly shifting such that the actual core methodology is Swift implementations, and then you will have a problem with the way you're doing it, yeah?
I think they will still have the solution for that. We haven't looked at that phase
yet. Okay.
Currently, we are working fine with Swift. Right, you cool. can compile. You can
yeah, that's,
compile.
That's important. Right. So, with Apple and their sensitivity to anything that they're not expecting you to do with the development, I mean, the whole App Store review process. There's tons of stories at the end of when they release a new iOS version that a developer has done something clever with an API, and they go, "Oh no, that wasn't intentional," and they deny their app being deployed. How sensitive are you guys to that, and how do you know that your pattern of what you're planning on doing will fit nicely with Apple? I mean, is that a risk that you have?
There is probably some risk always. For now, we haven't seen any problems with the way we do things.
And the more customers you have using it effectively, the less likely Apple will have a problem with it, which is really interesting.
Like, I hope so.
Yeah, you'll get to a certain point where it's a core feature that everybody wants, then you're good.
Yep.
Okay, so let's talk about a competitor. I don't know if any... I mean, I know that other companies are actually doing video recording, because when I was doing some research in your company, I noticed a list of them that are kind of doing this. What differentiates you, or is the space just large enough you're not concerned about? From a business perspective, what are your concerns or issues around that?
Well, obviously, we're familiar with the space, and there are other players in the space, so... from what we know, there are no player out there that delivers the quality of video that we do without slowing down the UI and passing App Store certification. Basically, there are three ways to record video in iOS. One is using undocumented APIs, which will work, but you won't be able to ship the app to the App Store. That's way number one.
Working with a big caveat.
Yeah. So that works, right? Number two would be to use the legitimate APIs, but they will slow down the UI beyond usability, right? You won't be able to ship the app or even use it in a beta testing. It just becomes unusable.
Can I guess what the next one is?
Yes.
You pseudo render all the content yourself in your own space?
No, and the third way is to use the documented APIs, but in a background thread as opposed to main thread, which will work, but will crash the app on occasion because UIKit is simply not
robust enough.
Thread safe. Not designed to be thread safe. So it will work for a while until you do something that it doesn't like, and it will eventually crash. So those are the three ways, and those are the three ways available on the market. And then we have our
way.
We have Dmitry's way.
The fourth way.
You don't have
to talk about it if you don't want to.
We won't.
Trust me, we won't. We worked really hard to develop our fourth way, which is basically doesn't slow down the UI, passes Apple certification, uses only legitimate APIs, and totally usable. And we have many customers in the app service.
That's fantastic. So you do have a bit of an edge then from your competitors.
That's very correct.
Okay, that's cool. Because of Dmitry here.
That's very correct.
That's good to have partners then, I guess.
Yeah.
Okay, so it's interesting because when I was taking my notes on what to ask you guys, I was going to talk about bug reports versus crash reports. But in a lot of ways, you're not really differentiating them. Whether the user – I mean, in my mind, a bug report is actually initiated by a user. Mm-hmm. And a crash report is – or some other kind of logging port is done because of a detectable stace.
Mm-hmm.
But in your pattern, it looks like – in a lot of ways, there's not a differentiation.
The only one difference in our case is that you will have a stack trace in the crash case.
Right.
That's the only, and everything else is the same. You get the video and the logs and and the network and all the traces and tons of other information.
It's the same.
It's identical. Actually, there's a third issue where it doesn't crash. It's not user reported, but rather in the code you decide that you're not supposed to be there, right?
Yeah.
So obviously that cannot be done with one line of code, but then we have APIs to say like, I want to detect that case and report me everything we normally report if you ever get to that condition. So we have that as well.
And you also have a lighter touch where it doesn't report everything, just kind of lets you know?
No, that reports everything because it's light enough.
That's the load
definition.
You do.
Yes.
Okay, let me ask you this then. I come along in an app. Okay, we'll use the beer example app because I'm in the middle of doing this on my sidelines. What the heck? So I've taken a picture of the beer that I'm drinking to kind of log that I actually had that beer. And there's a weird typo in the interface. So I'm a friend of, you know, I'm a beta program. So I shake the phone or take a screen capture. What do you guys use as a trigger event?
We have both.
Both. Okay. Yeah. So shake the device, and it tells me the bug report, and I say confirm, and I send it. Then within a minute, now the app crashes. The second video, were the two videos that I get from that instance, the one the user reported and the crash one, overlap each other?
No. The moment you click a submit button on the first time, we start a new recording.
Yeah, okay. Cool. So it makes sense. Because why have duplicate? Yeah. I'm just curious about your little subtle implementations. Was there anything else you guys want to talk about with your business? Do you have anything else you want to cover that we haven't actually touched upon? Are you hiring right now?
No, we're all set. We're all set right now. Okay. Yeah, we're all set right now.
But you are looking for developers?
As customers. As customers, yes, obviously.
And so you recently met Brian at a meetup about iOS development.
Brian Young.
Yeah, Brian Young, who's on the show regularly. And he, you guys started talking about coding and such. You're going to those meetups basically to get customers.
That's correct, yes. Yeah. Yes. So there is a lot of meetups here in Bay Area. We live in an amazing place here. Yeah. And the... You know, I live in San Jose, so it's very easy to just decide that one evening I'm free and my wife is happy with me leaving the kids with her. So I just pop out and, you know, see where I can hang out with the potential crowd that could be potentially our customers. And just, you know, we have, you know, friendly conversations over coffee or beer. And that's how I randomly ran into Brian. We had, you know, phenomenal chat. And then he said, you know what, you know, I'll introduce you to Lyle. Yeah. And that's how we got here.
Can you talk about some of your sample customers you actually have, or is it private?
Well, obviously it's private. I cannot disclose our customer names, but what I can say that we have a wide variety of customers, from small individual shops to huge companies, from private companies to large public companies.
How about how many like app starts you have, or any kind of statistics to kind of talk about the scale you're currently running at? Nothing public yet?
Well... Sure, you'll be the one to disclose that. How about that?
Okay.
So we're talking September 2nd today,
yes.
Right? So, and we rolled out in end of April. So we're talking about 4.5 months, and we have 797 customers signed up, with about pushing 1,000 developers, and about 1/4 of them used it in the past 30 days.
Nice.
Yes.
So that feels good.
Yes.
Yeah. You're... Service integration, like, are you running on somebody else's cloud infrastructure? Where are you running?
AWS.
AWS. Yeah.
You should know.
Yeah. Everybody does.
Yeah.
So you didn't get sucked in with Microsoft trying to pitch you a good Azure?
No.
They did pitch us. Yeah. He just doesn't know.
Yeah.
No, they did pitch us. We have some credits from Google as well. But we did AWS with our previous startup, with Dishero.
Once you get good at it, why go anywhere else?
Yeah, we already had a pre-existing setup, so we just... Kind of reused our knowledge of.
So because you've done that, your ability to scale with multiple customers or a giant customer coming online with millions of launches a day wouldn't really be a problem. You'd have to figure out the revenue at that point.
Yes.
Probably.
Yes. It's a tricky one though.
Yeah. So are you going to go for another round of funding? Are you going to go public? Are you just at this point looking to become stable financially through revenue when you set it? What's your plan?
Our immediate goal is to figure out revenue, so it will allow us to grow, and then we'll see. We'll see. It's going to be very interesting how that turns out. That's an experiment we haven't ran yet, and a few ideas that we have how we're going to ran that experiment, and once we do it, we'll figure out what's going to be the next step.
Yeah. Are you seeing a difference in your last company versus this one? Because you guys just did this and closed it. At this time frame from the menu company, you know, 6 months out, how different are they?
Oh, it's very, very different. And we have something to compare it to, right? So we see our, you know, customers signing up. We see customers signing up because their friends told us, because they use Bugsy and they want them to use that as well. Obviously, it's free, so that makes it a bit easier at this point.
A little easier to say yes.
Right. So I'll be honest about that. And then, you know, we've been live, as I said, for 4.5 months, and we have a lot of customers with big names trying to use us right now.
That's great.
Very, very impressive. So we were nowhere near in the same position in the previous company, and we had to invest way more into sales and marketing. Well, here, we do invest a bit in marketing, but generally speaking, it's all coming out from organic.
What percentage of marketing spend versus salary and AWS costs, like general costs versus marketing costs? What kind of percentage are we talking about?
So I'm running marketing, and I'm not a marketer in any shape or form. So I do an occasional experiments here and there with sponsoring certain newsletters or podcasts and see how that works out. So we still experiment with that. I don't have necessarily a strict answer.
Okay, cool. Fantastic. Thank you so much for speaking with me. It's been really fun. I look forward to loading this into my toy app and trying it out and seeing what it's like. And if I like it, I'll definitely spread the word here at Netflix too. Who knows?
Thank you for having us, Lyle.
Certainly. Thank you. Dimitri, thank you both very much.
Thank you.
Oh, and of course, it's bugsy.com. Wow, that's pretty good. Did you spend some money on that?
Yes, we did.
Bugsee.
As in see the bug.
See your bugs.
Right. That's the whole concept, right? It's all work of our multifaceted Dimitri Fink, as well as the logo, which is the anteater, which supposedly eats bugs.
Yep.
Also a conceived and drawn by our Dimitri Fink.
Yes.
I'm useless.
I bet he doesn't feel that way.
I don't know. He does the talking and he's running the business pretty much, all the other aspects of it.
Right. You just make sure everything works.
Yeah.
Yeah. That's good.
I just do the technical stuff.
Yeah. Great. Well, bugsee.com to learn more about it. If you're a developer for iOS, web, or can you sign up for the Android beta program right now?
Yes. So we don't advertise it, but if you sign up, it's available there and it says it's in beta.
Great. Right. So give it a shot if you're a developer. And thank you both for being here.
Thank you for having us.
Thank you again.
Well, that was a slightly different format of Geek Speak. I enjoyed it. I hope you did as well. That was actually a collection of recordings I've done since June. Just a couple things I'd put in the can for just the case where we couldn't get the geeks together to do a live show. But we will be doing a live show this coming week. Hey, if you've got news you'd like us to cover, please feel free to email us. We're geeks@geekspeak.org. And of course, we'd love your input. GeekSpeak is a Creative Commons Attribution 3.0. You can use our stuff any way you'd like. Just let them know we made it. And also a big thanks to Michael Newman of Pet Star Music for our theme song. And thank you for being here for episode 45 of season 16.